Yeah,
that, expresses the same concept, I'm afraid.
Accurate. I think that, you know, you could really get on kind of a track with this where you could wonder, well, I don't want to get too far-fetched, but look, how about the notion of the coup, which is just really consolidating power in fewer hands?
Mm-hmm.
And how about the notion that something like that could go on unnoticed by an entire population until the population that actually had consolidated the control over broad community had gotten reduced to fewer and fewer and fewer people, and, mm-hmm. until it was a very, very, very tiny percentage of the population that really was able to manipulate every community, rural and urban, in a very profound way. In my opinion, I think that we're seeing that occur, and I'm very optimistic, particularly here in Northern California. We've got a population that is, by and large, by national standards, very astute and very alert, and I think we've got more of an eye on what's going on than perhaps other areas in the country that are maybe more willing to take things on face value. And if I could make any kind of personal plea to people who are listening, it's just participate, really participate, and be aware of what's going on, and don't accept what you read in the newspapers, because it's not adequate. Your audience knows that, and the more diligent we are, and I know we all have to work hard and spend a lot of time earning a living, and it does take an awful lot of work to instead of relaxing and turning on the television and being inundated with that nonsense, to actually sit down and politically participate. But by God, it is absolutely called for now. We're going to have a real problem on our hands, and that is the truth.
The thing that I wanted to comment on was the observation that you just made, which is that you were hypothesizing, but at the same time expressing the thought that perhaps this is what we're seeing, namely a creeping coup, low intensity fascism. You know, I guess you could say to corrupt the term low intensity warfare that's become the U.S. counterinsurgency watchword over the last decade or so. One of the things that this audience is very familiar with is a passage from an excellent book called They Thought They Were Free that was authored by Michael Mayer, a professor at the University of Chicago. And he interviewed 10 Germans who initially were opposed to Hitler and eventually were won over to the Nazi point of view. And to me, the most revealing and moving of the passages that was in that particular book, and again, they Thought They Were Free by Michael Mayer, it was an interview with a German university professor who really described the subjective experience of living during the rise of Hitler and what it was like. And one of the things that he said was that if there had ever been one particular moment, one great huge incident in which the increase in totalitarianism was so great that everyone would have come out of the woodwork, so to speak, and I'm not using his exact words, then he said people might have resisted. But he said the thing that happened was that each step was so small and that each step was not much worse than the step before, so that if you don't protest at step A, step B isn't that much worse, so you're not going to protest at step B, and then C is not so much worse than B, so that if you didn't protest at B, why protest at C, and so on to D, and then E, and all the way on to Z. And in fact, the Nazis referred to this as salami taktik, just like slicing salami, one thin slice at a time. Now, there was, of course, the Reichstag fire, which, again, to me, echoes in unnerving fashion the mutterings about terrorists that you alluded to on the part of some of these state defense people. That, of course, was Hitler's cry, the communists are upon us, and therefore they had to suspend the Constitution and so forth.
Now, when you have groups that are prepared to see enemies, I mean, that's their reason for being, that they are there to respond to state enemies,
mm-hmm.
and who really don't have the capacity on their own to identify who the state enemies are, and are ready to respond to being told who they should take action against. I mean, that's what these people are preparing for. They're preparing, and I don't mean to indict all of them, because I've been to meetings with the state military reserve around here, and in fact, I've met the deputy commander, and I've met the commander of the state military reserve, and interviewed him. And he's a real nice guy. He's a retired general, and you look him in the eye, and you know there's a genuine human being there who really is responsive. And when, this is a little anecdote, I happened to have the mobilization plan along with me when I interviewed this guy. And I said, hey, what's all this business about keeping intelligence files on groups and individuals and all of this business about subversives? And I got to tell you, I was watching him, and he was absolutely shocked that that was in the mobilization plan. He didn't know it. And it had been prepared for him after a six-month effort by this Blue Ribbon Committee, and this guy didn't even know that this stuff was in it. And he was responsive. He said, that categorically does not belong in here. And apparently it was a deputy commander, a guy named Ronald Markarian, who's a loose nut who may have been responsible for a lot of the content of this document. But I don't mean to indict everybody in this agency. There are people who are there, I think, for a variety of reasons, including they miss a military environment. They like companionship. Some feel that they're actually contributing to their community in this way. I mean, I think they'd be better off contributing to the Red Cross. But they are not necessarily aware of the stated mission or the marching orders for the group. It's very poorly organized.
That's a good point, and it's also a point that we have made in the past, though perhaps not as often as we should have. One of the things that we've looked at in the past, and one of the reasons why some of the ruminations that you and I are engaging in are do not appear very far-fetched to this audience, is the fact that in 1934, in response to President Roosevelt's New Deal program, which in turn was a response to the Great Depression, a number of this country's top industrialists and financiers, notably the House of Morgan, the DuPonts, and interests of that type, tried to have a fascist coup. And in fact, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee was formed to investigate it, and the then commander, or the former commander of the U.S. Marine Corps, Smedley Butler, a two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor, was picked by the conspirators to head up the coup, but in fact being, at least in certain respects, like this general that you described, he was a genuine patriot, although perhaps a conservative and certainly a lifelong military man. He believed in constitutional government, so he betrayed the conspirators. But that's a situation which I think at the same time, deepens the sort of perception that you enunciated, which is that we should not lump all of these people together, because indeed some of these individuals are the very reasons why some of these things haven't gone forward in the past and why we have information about them. But it's also important to understand that, if there's an economic crisis, the notion of a fascist coup is in no way, alien to this society. It's happened before.
Well, you know, that's news to me. I wasn't aware of that plot that had been uncovered.
Excuse me for...
I think it's very important to be aware of historical, historic precedent and history to be able to examine trends that we see. It's also absolutely incumbent on us to use our heads and to not rely on historic precedent to tell us everything about what's going on, because things may not unravel that way. Things may take a different path. And the worst thing you can do is assume that this population is invulnerable to the kind of political changes that occur, and have occurred and occur all the time in oppressive, when there are very oppressive regimes elsewhere. We are in no way different than any other group of people on Earth. We are absolutely as vulnerable to that kind of manipulation if we don't pay attention. And I believe that one of the problems we're having that we really have to work very hard to avoid having deteriorate anymore is that we don't really have an active press scrutinizing the things on the behalf of the community that we did 20 years ago. There are not good investigative journalism, a lot of digging going on to tell us what's going on, and that's of real concern. And it may not be the fault of reporters, although I suggest that there probably aren't as many vigilant reporters as there were, but it certainly is the fault of editors, whether that's a deliberate neglect or whether it's just a tacit neglect, who can say. But you know very well that if we lose reliable news media in this country, which is the only thing that ties this community together. I mean, it's a very tenuous thing, a nation. It really is an abstract. It's whatever we have in mind that we agree our common behavior is going to be. And if we lose real track of what's going on in our community, if we don't get adequate information, if we refuse to demand adequate information, we're sunk. And what we have been conditioned to believe we have as a community is, in fact, a figment of our imagination at that point and has no basis in reality.
Adlai Stevenson had a phrase that I think sums up neatly what you were driving at. In a democracy, people usually get the kind of government they deserve.
Yeah, that sounds accurate.
Listen, Ed, why don't we take a break at this point? I'll give the listeners a chance to stretch back and listen to a little bit of jazz while you get your tapes queued up, and we'll see if we can get these on the air here, and then we'll proceed with that information. And again, before we get off here, I want to get some particulars from you, again, concerning exactly where people can call or write, both with regard to the Maxine Waters hearing coming up tomorrow and for any future action, and also perhaps some particulars about your Mercury article, your Covert Action article, and where people who would like more information could contact you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Happy to help.
Okie doke. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a musical break here. I'll stop the tape for the benefit of people who may eventually hear this on other radio stations. We're going to take a break now. We will resume the discussion with Ed Connolly, Bay Area political researcher and author, after a musical break. Okie doke. Here we go. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. Due to the dictates of time, the greatest of dictators, due to the fact that it's going to be kind of tough to put those tapes that Ed has on the air, we're going to wrap things up now and get some information from Ed about where people can go to pursue these issues further, both in terms of getting more information and in terms of doing something to affect the outcome. So, good evening, Ed. Are you back here with us? Ed, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. So, tell you what, why don't you tell us now... Okay, why don't you give us some information, if you would, about specifically where people can call, which I guess is the only thing they have time to do with regard to the hearings tomorrow that Maxine Waters is having, and perhaps where they might write both to... put pressure on various representatives and interests to act in the future, because certainly the issue isn't going to wither and die one way or the other tomorrow. Also, if you could give information again about the Mercury article that's coming up, Covert Action article, and perhaps give an address where people who would like more information could contact you.
Yeah, be glad to. By the way, I think I have that tape queued up. I didn't listen to it, but I think I have the right tape on the right side, so I don't know how it'll come through the phone receiver, but it might prove interesting. Here's the situation again with the state government. There are two parallel processes when budgets are in the process of being approved. There's a proposal for an amount allocated for each department, and then within that, items within each department. And there are hearings on the House side, and there are hearings on the Senate side. And then there are recommendations that budget analysts make to have various sections of the budget either approved or not approved. The Senate side of this and the House side of this budget process, I'm no expert on it, and maybe I'm going over material you and your listeners are already aware of. But there are bills introduced, both in the House and in the Senate, that are basically the budget. And as I understand it, the House side of the bill is actually introduced in the Senate, and the Senate side of the bill, which is a completely different bill with completely different recommendations on funding. They're two concurrent but parallel and independent processes towards the budget approval. The Senate bill... that is the budget, is introduced in the House. And traditionally what the Senate and the House do is vote down those bills. And so in turn those bills are sent to a committee. And at that committee, there are six members on the committee, and that's where a lot of political give and take occurs in order to hammer out a completed budget for the following fiscal year. To make a long story short, this is at a very late date on the House side of reviewing the budget proposals for the various departments. And this is kind of one of the last opportunities to really make some changes in budget proposals. And so this is a crucial hearing. Whether or not this results in any changes this year, I don't know. But at least it's a precedent and would carry some weight in the following budget recommendations for the next fiscal installment. To make a long story short, the hearing again is Maxine Waters' subcommittee, Ways and Means Subcommittee on State Administration. That's a House subcommittee. It's going to occur at the state capitol on Tuesday, May 2nd at 4 in the afternoon. You can call Maxine Waters, Chief of Staff, for information at area code 916-445-2363. His name is Ross Clark, and he is very interested in calling in the state military reserve officials, and I'm sure that if the public responds and provides some input in a very measured way, that will count favorably in their scrutiny of this agency.
One more time, Ed, if you could, about the phone number and the date and time and so forth.
Okay. It's Tuesday, May 2nd, 4 p.m. at the state capitol. It's Maxine Waters, who's a real fighter. She's an assemblywoman from Los Angeles. Comes from Watts District, as a matter of fact, so I'm sure she'd be concerned about armed paramilitary groups that may respond to civil disorder. It's the State Ways and Means Subcommittee on State Administration in the State Capitol, Sacramento, May 2nd, 4 p.m. For more information, let me give you two numbers. You can call Ross Clark, who is Maxine Waters' Chief of Staff. He can be reached at area code 916-445-2363. Alternatively, you can call Jeanette Rapp, R-A-P-P, who is a legislative analyst. And her number, and she is going to bat for this thing, too. Her number is area code 916-445-7082.
Okay, Ed, one more time for the Clark and Rapp phone numbers, if you would, please.
Ross Clark, who is Maxine Waters' Chief of Staff. Maxine Waters is the assemblywoman who is head of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on State Administration, who will be examining this budget. And Clark's number is area code 916-445-2363. Alternatively, you can reach Jeanette Rapp, who is a legislative analyst for the budget, and she is very favorably disposed to, she's bringing up her own concerns as a result of inquiries I've made about the state military reserve, and so she has some questions she's going to be asking, too. Jeanette Rapp's number, legislative analyst, is area code 916-445-7082. And I think the more public scrutiny that this process gets, the better. Now, you mentioned future action, and the reason I went through that little description of the budget process is that the opportunity to do anything about this on the Senate side passed this last Monday when the military budget was passed without any controversy on the Senate side. I didn't really contact anybody there until it was too late. But there is an outside chance, if there is enough urgency about the public responding to this, to have the Senate version's recommendations reconsidered. And the guy who you want to reach to question about the state military reserve is Senator Alan Robbins, that's R-O-B-B-I-N-S, of Van Nuys. Of course, you'd reach him in the state capitol, and you can reach his office at area code 916-445-3121. And the reason you want to reach Senator Alan Robbins is to request reconsideration of funding the state military reserve. Again, Senator Alan Robbins is head of the Senate budget process. I don't know exactly what it's the boy, I wish I could remember the name of the it's the Senate Budget Committee that he is head of, and you want to ask Senator Allen Robbins to reconsider the state military reserve funding for this next fiscal year. So those are two ways that people can help in a concrete way bring some legislative scrutiny to this state agency that's out to corral subversives and terrorists and anybody who apparently is going to be dissenting a war emergency effort. And I'm hoping that there are a lot of people who fall into that category in our audience here. They're definitely of concern, and they warrant legislative and public scrutiny.
Well, hopefully we can head them off with a checkbook.
Well, yeah, it's probably the best opportunity to make a difference it really hits them where they count. Now, they're a volunteer agency. The people who are in the cadre now, and there are about 800 people involved out of the 1,500 total cap the cadre has. Once again, they operate at cadre strength. If they're mobilized, the state authorizes up to 20,000 in the ranks of the state military reserve. And this cadre is a nucleus of officers who would marshal and direct the people who would be brought in under a mobilization. But the people in the cadre operate, do what they do now for free. Some of them, in San Jose, for example, dedicate up to 2,000 hours a year gratis. And what they're doing is a little frightening. Now, I think I've got a recording just about queued up here. And maybe I'll just play a little bit of it. These are just rough excerpts from a lot of interviews that I've made, but two in particular, one from a guy named Ernest Grave. Yeah, there it is. Let me give you a little bit of background.
Okay.
Were people who are interested in scrutinizing these groups firsthand, they are very active here in the Bay Area. They meet at National Guard armories at various intervals. In San Jose, which is probably the nearest battalion, they meet at the National Guard armory that's at the corner of Heading Street and Guadalupe Parkway. It's right near the airport. That's Heading Street and Guadalupe Parkway. Every Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, there's a battalion of about 35 people. They're commanded by someone who just retired from the Sheriff's Department, who used to, from what I understand, supervise work crews from Meadowbrook, or I can't remember the name of the low-security prison. And there's a guy named Ernest Glaive, who is a captain in the battalion, the State Military Reserve, who's a jeweler in San Jose, who organized the battalion. And I just wanted to play this little excerpt from an interview that I had with Glaive to give you a kind of a feeling for people who are in the San Jose Battalion and what they may be concerned about.
Okay.
Hold on.
Sure. The tape is in preparation.
Not in a second.
Okay.
We know what's going on. We've had training with the 36-inch baton, and that's what you use in riot training. You do not whip out weapons like they do in Europe. We whip out the baton. Although we have people in our organizations, as myself, which is a sharpshooter, and we have quite a few. We're all qualified with weapons.
Did that come through okay?
It came in very nicely, yeah. That was very good sound quality under the circumstances.
Yeah, there's more. I don't want to bore you with too much.
Well, no, listen. What I'm going to do is this basically is going to constitute the prepared portion for this evening, and then I can pick up the other information next week. So don't worry about it. But after this, we're going to go to the phone calls, because I'm sure listeners have had their interest stimulated. I'd be willing to bet on it, and I'm interested to see what they have to say in response to some of the information that you've been presenting.
Can I beg off? I'll tell you why.
What's
that? Someone has kind of organized a dinner for me here this evening, and I'm keeping them waiting downstairs. Can we maybe make an arrangement to get together on air at a later date?
Sure. Oh, sure. No problem. Well, no, listen, I don't want to keep you from your dinner because, first things first. You know, food before war, I guess you could say. But
food, not bombs.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to beg off, but I'd really look forward to taking some calls.
No, I didn't. When I said taking phone calls, I didn't necessarily mean for you, because I would be taking phone calls here myself. We don't have a means for doing that on air anyway. So no, that
right.
I meant, you know, I'm going to go to the phones and, you know, I'm just going to get the listener's response for my own purposes. I can send you a tape because I will be taping their response if you'd like to hear how they respond. But no, I meant when I said let you know, proceed, I meant with the tape if you wanted to play a little bit more of the tape, because again, this is going to be on permanent file with this tape duplication service, so people can either listen to it on their own, or some of the other stations that air my archive tapes can also access this if they so choose. But if you'd like to
sure.
Get some more excerpts of that on.
A few more little random excerpts, and I'll give you a little introduction to them. Glaive continues... the nature of the interview was such that I needed to have certain questions answered. One of the questions is, they plan to have weapons issued to them. And although there's currently a prohibition on them getting their hands on firearms during peacetime, and the prohibition is only a directive from the Adjutant General, they circumvent that restriction by going out with the National Guard on invitation on exercises, and they do things like scoring target practice and that kind of thing. So if they have a benevolent National Guard commander, they get their hands on M16s, and I was told by people in the San Jose Battalion, specifically a guy named Pendleton and by other people down there, that that they fired M60 machine guns, and one guy told me they'd fired 50 caliber machine guns, which I guess is a blast, perhaps, but you know, what that has to do with any reasonable missions for volunteers beats me.
Well, it certainly is a very expeditious means of crowd control, if you get right down to it.
Well, 50-caliber machine guns are one of the best means for crowd control ever invented, in my estimation. You don't have to worry much about about controlling crowds with that kind of armament. Now,
exactly.
I'm not suggesting that they're actually going to use that. I think they're confined to, you know, M14s, according to the mobilization plan. So they're not quite so heavy as the 50-caliber machine guns. But I suppose it pays to be, you know, in practice with all the available military weapons. But hold on. This will just take a minute or two, and then I'm going to clear out.
Sure.
Hold on. Kind of starts and stops.
We go out with the guard. The guard has now given the consent that when we do go out on the range and act as range masters, which we have done, because we've got people that train their people, we then are allowed to fire weapons on the range. Which so the SMR does remain in practice, is qualified with weapons, under the auspices of the National Guard on invitation for the National Guard. Exactly. Now, I myself go out to private ranges, and I practice with my own weapon, as well as other people in our organization do. As I mentioned before, we have police and sheriffs in our organization, and naturally they have to keep qualifying. And they also instruct us on things. We go through it. Instructions on the different weapons and the nomenclature and everything else to keep up on it and how to handle it in case we have to and or are issued them.
When the National Guard goes and the SMR is mobilized in a big mobilization, what happens?
Then we will then be issued weapons. We would have to be in order to defend the armories, yes.
How did you find out about the SMR and how were new people recruited?
Well, most of them are recruited, to answer your last question first, by word of mouth. We are selective. As I stated earlier, we try to recruit people that are compatible. Like the vehicles that our people have restored are not museum pieces. They
I've forgotten there's a gap there. What he went on to say later on in the tape is that they have an armored personnel carrier. He calls it a weapons carrier, as well as jeeps and ambulances, and that these vehicles are not museum pieces, that they're restored, they may be Korean War vintage, but that they're ready to roll, that they use them on exercises, and they use them in a parade. They parade every Veterans Day down in San Jose. Nobody seems to know what they're all about, though. And there are other battalions around the states who have restored tanks. Part of the state military reserve, they have a an organization called the, I don't know, it's like museum group or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
But they're far from restoring things for museum purposes, and that was the point of it. Now, this recording goes on. I've got pieces of an interview with a guy named Richard Grossman, who is a policeman in the Walnut Creek Police Department, who is their chief weapons and civil disorder trainer. And I taped an interview with him out at a so-called at a civil disturbance training exercise that was held at Camp Hart's back at the beginning of March, where the 49th Military Police Battalion of the National Guard called in this guy Grossman from the State Military Reserve as an official of the State Military Reserve to train the 49th Military Police Battalion. And along in the exercise, there were 20 ROTC cadets from Oakland High School. It was the first time I knew there was an ROTC program in high schools, for that matter, in riot control techniques. And he trained them how to wield truncheons and how to spray tear gas and other chemical agents on demonstrators. And the interview that goes on this tape, and I probably don't have time to play it for you now, but is his idea of what he's doing, why he's there, and what the mission of the SMR is. Actually, what he says is that the SMR would have absolutely nothing to do with civil disturbances, which seems strange considering his involvement in the group, and it's also strange in the fact that it flatly contradicts their written mission statement in the state documents and also the new mobilization plan. And so anyway, I think that's going to be about as much as I can provide for you this evening, Dave, and I really appreciate the time for relating this budget process on the California State Military Reserve that is up for renewal this week, and in particular on Tuesday at 4 o'clock at the State Capitol at Maxine Waters Ways and Means Subcommittee. And I hope that we can discuss this at some other time.
Okay, certainly. Well, again, there are a lot of fascinating aspects to it. The word of mouth aspect, which renders it, at least in certain respects, almost kind of an occult action group, you know, really is disturbing to me. But that, yeah, it'd be great to kick this around at a future date.
Yeah, you heard that information from the horse's mouth. If anybody has any curiosity about the groups locally, hey, head down to the battalion in San Jose on Wednesday night. You ought to put your 2 cents in and say that you're curious about the State Military Reserve and you'd like to attend the meeting. Give it a shot. They've turned other people away, but there's no reason not to be persistent. And, you know, that was Captain Ernest Glaive, who's a captain in the State Military Reserve and runs a jewelry business down in San Jose there. So, look, thank you again, and I'll bow out now. Let's stay in touch. I look forward to providing some more information about this stuff.
Okay, well, I'm sure the listeners will have a lot of interesting things to say. As I say, this tape will be on permanent file with archives on audio. Our tape duplication service may very well be aired on other stations. If you like to, the listener responses will be tape recorded, and I can arrange to get you a copy of that if you'd like to hear how they respond to the information we presented here.
Yeah, that's great. Let's get together. I'd really like to get a copy of the tape, Dave.
Okie doke, will do.
Right.
Okay, thanks so much, Ed.
Thank you again.
Okie doke. And that concludes the prepared portion in a somewhat different fashion than had been anticipated here. Again, that was Ed Conley, a Bay Area political researcher and author. Has an article coming up, I believe he said, this Tuesday. Oh, unfortunately, I didn't get an address as to where to contact him. But anyway, this coming Tuesday in the San Jose Mercury and the current issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin has an article by Ed on the State Defense Forces. So there are two printed sources where you can go to gain more information.